Tuesday, April 16th, a little bit after 5 o'clock, and you know what that means, everybody. It's time for Tasty Lives All New. Can I still say all new, or have we been going too long to use that frame? I don't know. All new evening show, The Price of Truth, a little podcast where we explore the incentives that govern our world. The idea is to have great minds come on and share great ideas. Today is no different. We have with us our good friend, excuse me, my man, Chris Vecchio. Chris, how you doing?
Better today, because I've been flat in the market for 2 days, and so I haven't been enjoying this pain in the S&P.
Today wasn't too painful, but yeah, like the last couple of days have been, I don't know, 1-2% rolls. It is what it is. I should announce to the world that you are going to be a new fixture on the show on Tuesday. So we're going to get to chop it up just like old days, check in once a week. So we'll offer some continuity in our conversations, and I'm excited for that. And I'm sure the audience here is as well. Hit the like button, subscribe to the channel. Tell us how you feel about that in the chat. Tell us where you're watching from as well. You excited to go on this little journey again, man?
Let's figure out what we got wrong last time.
Fair enough. I did not expect that. I am curious, though, because a few weeks ago, I think you had a positive perspective on risk. It seems the tea leaves are turning just a little bit. I would say maybe for the short term. I don't know if the midterm, you know, people are taking a massively risk-off position. I know I follow some people that aren't necessarily afraid of a bit of, you know, 5-10% correction, but those that are sort of trading on a more frequent basis, that's something you don't necessarily want to get run over by. What's your perspective of risk right here, right now?
It feels like at the end of March, all the traders were saying this market's gone too far, too fast, and investors were looking around and saying it's really not a big deal. We're up like 8% from where we were at the start of 2022. And now, 2 weeks later, it feels like traders are saying, I can't believe that we're down this far this quickly. And investors are saying, what's the big deal? Nothing's changed. At the end of the day, that's the market, right? People with different time frames shouting over one another. But what has changed, I think, actually falls onto something that we got right 2 weeks ago, which is funny things happen in markets when oil gets to $85 a barrel. Mm-hmm. And yields have pushed higher, and DBC, the Deutsche Bank Commodity Tracking Fund, continues to break out. Now, granted, it's mostly an energy product, for, you know, mind you, but commodity prices are up, and bond yields are up, and the Fed today finally acknowledges that we may not be able to get rate cuts this year. So the game has changed. A lot's changed in the past 2 weeks. But some of the writing was on the wall 2 weeks ago.
It was. And like we had been talking about it offline, you know, the bear steepening that started to happen, the absolutely disgusting bear steepening in the curve was in many ways, if you want to call that the signal, you want to call gold rally the signal, you want to call crude, all these things are connected in a way. They're all sort of connected to yields. And regardless of which signal you were paying attention to, all of these things were signaling you were seeing higher rates, higher cost of long-term capital, and that at some point is likely to be factored into risk. It hadn't been, but the market sort of traded sideways for the last couple of weeks until the last few days. I'm curious, do you think this is just one big macro trade? In other words, when you tend to see macro matter, you get correlations that go to one, and the idiosyncrasies of earnings here or this company's laying off 10% of their workers over there, none of it seems to work like you would think it should work because it's all performing as one trade. Do you see the market right now sort of one big macro trade, or do you see there's still some room for idiosyncratic opportunities?
I see it as one big macro trade. And, you know, incidentally enough, I feel like you and I were discussing reflation and reacceleration a few weeks ago. I saw that Zero Hedge put out an article about how the reflation trade is the new bullish narrative. And certainly when you look at oil and you look at gold and you look at bonds, the reflation is there. But one of the big differences for bonds this time around is not that yields are moving higher in anticipation of what the Fed is going to do. They're moving higher because they're embedding higher inflation expectations.
Correct.
And so by that account, when you look at the correlation between bonds and, say, oil or bonds and gold, you're seeing an environment that's reflective of the fact that there is probably going to be a future where real yields go lower. They actually haven't in the short term, but the idea there would be if the Fed keeps rates where they are and inflation goes up, then the difference between the Fed funds rate and CPI or PCE or PC, that shrinks. And so the real Fed funds rate is actually going down over time. And by that measure, that's a good environment for gold. Now, what's driving that environment happens to be oil. So oil and gold are effectively the same trade right now. Inflation expectations getting pushed up as well, moves over into bonds. So bonds and oil have effectively been the same trade. Now, obviously, there's been a disconnect here the past 2 days because bonds have continued to sell off while oil really hasn't gone anywhere. And oil's had a lot of volatility, but it hasn't really gone anywhere for the past week plus. But I see that all as standing on the same footing. The issue for bonds right now in the short term is, what if oil prices do get a significant pullback and they're not able to respond? That would be a sign that the market is leveled in, or at least priced in a higher level of sticky inflation. And perhaps, not that there's really any reason to think this is the case, but maybe even some concerns over fiscal stability.
Let's expand that a little bit, just in case somebody's following you and they're not on the same page with what you just said. So what you just said is, if you get a pullback and the Fed is not able to respond, expand that out, make that a little bit easier for people to understand exactly what's all packed in that statement.
One thing that you hear Tom and Tony talk about, using this as an allegory, you know, if they look at market price action, today's a good example. Oh, volatility came in. Were they able to rally the spoos? No. That may be a little bit of a tell. You know, S&P was selling off while vol was going up. Now vol's going back down, but the S&P isn't rallying. That's interesting. Right? Traders aren't ready to jump back in per se. It feels like that could be the same situation here with oil and bonds. If oil has been the predominant factor pushing up bond yields in recent weeks and months, one would then presume that a pullback in oil prices would be good for bonds. Yields should come down. So in the event that we do see oil come off, and I'm thinking very specifically, right? You look at oil over the past several months. I want to go back to that September high that we had last year. If you were to just draw a horizontal line across the chart right at the September high, you could see where we've been kind of finding support right around 84, 84.50, depending upon if you're looking at the CLK4 or the CLM4 contract in the futures market. But either way, I mean, if you get below 84 here and oil starts pulling back because of the perceived lack of geopolitical risk premia being realized, there's a lot pumped in right now. Fear is in the market, but not necessarily realization of that fear. And bonds aren't able to stage a significant rally, you have a big problem on your hands. But you know why that may be a problem, Vic? Because bonds usually trade higher when you have risk on the table, right? When there's geopolitical risk on the table, the bond market is seen as a place for safety. Oil hasn't given up its gains. Gold hasn't given up its gains. Bonds are not gaining. And so that makes me real worried about the bond market right now. I have no position in it right now. I have no intention of getting long. I see that volatility is up, but I see support nowhere nearby. And this is a market that still has rate cuts priced in for this year. So I can't say I see a long bond trade here at the moment. The bet previously was, do you think that we're not going to get a cut in the first half of the year? I said that a lot. Now the question is, do you think that we're even going to get cuts at all? And if cuts are coming off the board still, there still may be more bond weakness baked into this cake. 20% chance of a cut in June. So that those odds in the SR3 contract have to go somewhere. And so if we don't get a cut in June, what happens? That contract's going to continue to weaken. So there may be still some opportunities here to trade the whole no cut thing in the first half of 2024, even if treasuries themselves have already priced it in.
What would you say if you've sort of acknowledged that this is a possibility? I'm just going to make it more explicit. So if somebody were to say, I think the things that could be pushing bonds higher, bond yields higher, are not necessarily the things that are pushing crude oil higher. That crude oil is being pushed higher by lower perceived or potential supply and through geopolitical conflict. But long end yields are higher due to the market potentially considering the fact that the Fed might cut in the short term and what the ramifications would be to long-term the unanchoring of long-term inflation expectations, and or perhaps that we're not as restrictive as maybe some had originally thought when we moved up by, you know, up to 5.25. And so in that case, you start to get the long end moving higher and wanting more yield to take duration risk. you're pointing to that being a potential. Do you have any sort of feeling on what the probabilities are that if oil turns around, how would you sort of rank the probabilities that long end yields just follow crude? I would say less than 50-50 that happens. What do you think?
I think the fact, and what's changed my mind, if we had this conversation on Friday, I actually would have a different perspective than I do today.
Okay.
Which seems odd because how much changes in a macro person's point of view in the span of 72 or 96 hours, you'd think not a lot. But the fact that bonds are continuing to set new lows while oil is no longer rallying is what gives me cause of concern. Can't say I'm surprised that bonds are weaker in the face of higher oil prices. We had that exact conversation at the start of the month. If oil gets above 85, funny things could happen to the bond market. Funny things happen to stocks once bonds start paying attention to oil. And what's been the case for the past 2.5 weeks? Markets are paying more attention to oil, bonds are following them, stocks struggling with that perception. It's been a long time since we had oil-related headlines driving markets, probably since the start of the Russia-Ukraine war, maybe even that summer, summer 2022. So that's why if you told me on Friday, what are the odds that bonds follow oil, I would say, oh, yeah, probably like 70-80%. If oil comes off, bonds are going to fall. But bonds haven't succeeded. They haven't taken advantage of the safe haven environment. Neither has the yen, by the way. So what makes you think that on the other side of it, that they're going to substantially outperform? Maybe you could make the case oil prices down, inflation expectations off. Okay, bonds can rally a little bit. But if they don't, that's really where you got your problem on your hands. So I look at ZN, I look at ZB. I see vol up, but not super duper high. I'm not sure if that's a technical term, but it just goes to show that I think this is like patience. There's a lot of technical damage done here on these charts recently. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the S&P, same thing with the NASDAQ, same thing with the Russell. I feel pretty confident still that we're going to be at 55, 5,600 in the S&P this year before the year comes out to a close. I don't know if that's starting today or tomorrow, and so I'm willing to wait because I don't see anything on my chart that says time to get bulled up on bonds or stocks at these levels.
I know the probabilities are low, but let me ask you right now. Let's just imagine we freeze markets, we fast forward, markets are exactly where they are right now, and we're in the June timeframe, which has a low probability of a cut. But let's just imagine you get a cut in June. What do you think that means for yields in the long end of the curve? Do you think you see what would normally happen when the Fed starts a cutting cycle, where you see long and short-term yields come in? Or do you think there seems to be a growing, I don't want to call it consensus, but a growing narrative in the market that if the Fed cuts too early, that long end of that curve is going to throw an additional tantrum, and that long end borrowing costs are going to get more expensive, which can obviously have implications for regional banks, commercial real estate, the housing market, because that long end transmits to the economy instantly versus moving the Fed funds rate, which has long and variable lag. So my specific question is, if we fast forward, we're in June and you get a cut in the front end, where would your money be on how the long end responds?
One of two things would probably have to happen between now and June 20th, I believe is the meeting date.
I don't know the date offhand, but yeah, something like that.
June 12th. So what would have to happen, one of two things happens between now and June 12th to get your rate cut on June 12th. Inflation takes a dramatically turn for the better the next few months, which considering we've been averaging 0.3% month over month in the recent string of months, that doesn't seem likely. And we can't get to a 2%, below 2.5% headline CPI unless we rattle off a bunch of 0.1 or 0.2% month over months in a row. So that seems unlikely. For us to do that, you'd probably have to see a lot of labor market weakness in quick order or something happening internationally. The point is that to get a cut in June, it's probably a break glass in case of emergency type of situation where something so bad has happened that the Fed has needed to dramatically shift forward its expectations. Not so different than what we saw last March, right around the regional banking crisis, where all of a sudden the market went from saying, you know, we're going to get to a 5.25% Fed funds rate by the end of this year to the Fed's going to be cutting down to 375. right? Like, that's the kind of thing that would happen to the market for the Fed to actually cut in June. You'd have to see such a dramatic shift where something horrible has happened. Is that good for stocks? No, probably good for bonds. But if we're in the same spot where we are today and the Fed cuts, I think you get your tantrum. I don't see a market here that would accept the Fed cutting rates in the face of what's been sequentially rising inflation pressures, both in CPI and PCE in headline and in core. When you look at 1 month, 3 months, 6 month annualized rates, the pace of inflation has actually started to turn the corner, which is the problem. Before it was disinflating at a slower pace, now it's starting to inflate again. So for the Fed to cut in the face of rising inflation, there would be an absolute tantrum. The market would want to send a signal to the Fed that you're doing the absolute wrong thing here.
Isn't the tricky thing here? This is why I was really, really, I was a bit surprised on the market's reaction to the inflation print, because it was as if the whole market, there was no forward-looking aspect to the market. Like, literally, you get a hot inflation print and everyone prices hot inflation. So to me, it was like the whole market is backward-looking. And isn't that the, aren't we in between the 3% to 2%, if that's really where we are? Isn't this the dangerous part, where if we're completely backward looking and the whole market's got to see, 2%, or at least looking like we're getting towards that 2%, by the time you see that in backward looking data, it's probably too late. And so the whole difficulty here is to strike a balance between what backward-looking inflation data with all these lag statistics and weird substitution and hedonics and OER and all the stuff we know is sort of weird about this number, and things like trueflation, which are showing, you know, the real market pricing of inflation is somewhere south of 2%. Like, there's got to be a balance between these two things, and it seems like whatever the market saw in the previous inflation print, coupled with copper and some of these industrial base metals ripping, that was enough to say, like, this is a problem. And I don't know, part of the cynical part of me thinks, I'm not totally convinced that forward inflation is a problem yet. And it also depends on what the long end of the curve is doing. And the long end of the curve seems to be saying that if the Fed doesn't take care of this, we're gonna take care of this. And with trueflation or real-time market prints at 2% and the long end of the curve saying one way or another, this is happening, some part of me thinks about forward inflation. I'm less concerned about forward inflation if that's the case. Because there's an ultimate, it seems like the long end of the curve is giving the Fed an ultimatum. You do it or we will.
I get what you're saying. And part of me is partial to that perspective. The inflation debate's really complicated because depending upon how you measure inflation, you're gonna get a bunch of different numbers, right? And people could even go to the Atlanta Fed has an inflation dashboard where they actually compile like the Cleveland Fed, the Dallas Fed mean, and this and that, the other thing. You could see all these different measures of ways of viewing inflation. Some are still 5%, 6%, others are like 2%. Trueflation, last time I saw it was bouncing around like 1.83 or 1.84%. If we measured inflation here in the United States the way they do in the Eurozone, core inflation would be below 2% right now. Mm. So you're right, as in terms of a forward-looking measure, are the CPI prints we're seeing in PCE that we're seeing worthwhile? No, I mean, we know that the rent component and the owner's equivalent rent component are problems, they're lagging. But there's also the reality of the market right now that because of the structure of the housing market itself, we can't get proper price clearance. Back in 2008, 40% or so of all mortgages were floating rate, were adjustable rate mortgages. So when rates went up, you took a kick. Now less than 5% of rates are floating rate, or 5% of mortgages are floating rate. So rates go, you know this to be the case, Mr. 275, when mortgage rates go from 275 to 8, doesn't affect you, but it definitely impacted the housing market and the broader economy in the mid-2000s. And that means that people are looking at higher mortgage rates and saying, do I want to move? Well, if I move, if I wanted to have the same cost of living, I'm going to have to downsize significantly. Mm-hmm. Because to get my new home, it's going to cost that much more. So I might as well not move. So you can't have supply coming into the market at a time when, as we know, supply has just been awful. So the Fed keeping rates elevated, in fact, in some sectors, maybe facilitating a supply shock. Which I know that Dylan Radigan's made that point, like until the Fed cuts rates, the housing market can't clear, and then you can't get the housing price correction.
But again,
I know they're home built.
It depends on what the long end does, though, on the cut. But yes, I agree. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Right. That's ultimately the tell. But I mean, Vic, this is becoming such a convoluted conversation because there's so much book talking and political animus here in play about inflation. Mm-hmm. And you and I were chopping it up before the show, thinking about things. And absent the Federal Reserve, or I guess the bond market, who is actually serious about fighting inflation right now on a policy level? I mean, is it Biden? I mean, is it the congressional Republicans? Take a step back and think about this. We covered this last time. But every time you get a continuing resolution, it's coming off of a budget that was conjured up by Pelosi, Schumer, and Biden when Democrats had the trifecta. So with gridlock in D.C., it could be a Democratic president and a split Congress or a Republican president and a split Congress. As long as there's gridlock, policymakers are not getting real about addressing the deficit. And deficits have inflation potential behind them because you're increasing aggregate demand. And when demand outstrips supply, prices tend to go up. So, you know, there's your rebuttal to MMT in one sense.
Okay, so
We also know from history the Republicans under Trump did not cut deficits. Correct. So that's not changing. And I mean, what other option is there out there? I mean, Trump's policy is coming in right now. Let's say he's going to change things up. Report in the last 24 hours, his advisors are on record saying, like, we're going to figure out how to weaken the U.S. dollar so that we can increase our trade abroad. They're also talking about all these new tariffs. Tariffs are a tax on consumers. We pay them for importing the goods abroad. When I buy something from China, the Chinese company isn't paying that tariff. I'm paying the tariff. And that money goes in the U.S. government's pockets, out of my pocket. So tariffs and a weaker dollar, that's also inflationary. So who's going to solve this right now? I mean, I think you're right. The bond market's stepping in and saying, we need this rate adjustment period to prevent inflation from getting back out of control right now. Is it necessarily a problem for stocks? Maybe more so in recent days. But is it a problem for stocks? Well, Vic, if earnings rise 7%, but the cost of capital rises 5 or rises 3, then real earnings growth is still positive. It's only once inflation subsumes earnings growth. Big problem in 2022, earnings growth was negative all year long. So inflation running higher than nominal earnings, real earnings growth is negative, and the cost of capital is going up, big problem for valuations. Right now, it's not. So a lot to think about.
Game this out with me, because everyone is stuck on what I think is like the next, let's call it the next 6 months. But let's imagine the market is a discounting mechanism for 9 to 12 months in the future, which puts us post election. And imagine either candidate wins. Does Jerome Powell, let's imagine Jerome Powell is able to navigate higher for longer and there's no rate cuts post election. Does either president want to reelect Jerome Powell? And then what does that ultimately mean for how the market will perceive risk after the whole higher for longer game? Whether you cut, you don't cut. Let's imagine he can keep them where they're at into the end of the year. Does he have a job? And if he doesn't have a job, what type of Fed chair does each of those presidents want as they take their second term, in your mind?
I don't think Powell has a job either way. I think that even though President Trump is the one who appointed him, he's made very clear in plain language that he thinks that he's a political meddler and makes policy decisions, because in Trump's mind, an organization is controlled and run by one person, even though the FOMC votes are weighted equally. But he thinks that Powell walks in the room and says, we're cutting rates today. I don't care what any of you think. Enjoy the next lunch for the 2 hours before I have to go out and speak in front of the podium. Like, that's not how the world works, but that's Trump's view. He thinks that Powell is the person pulling every single lever. Now, the Fed chair does have outsized influence, of course, but it's still just one vote. So I would say that Powell doesn't have a job under Trump. And I think that, as we see Democratic presidents typically do, they carry over the old Fed chair, they renew the term, and then if they have the opportunity to appoint a new Fed chair after the old one's continuation term has expired, then they do so. So Biden already reappointed Powell for the sake of having, you know, stability in monetary policy coming out of the pandemic. Makes a good deal of sense. You don't change pilots mid-flight, as it were. But I think he probably wants someone like Lael Brainard in there, who's been on the inside, who has policy views that are a little bit more in line with mainstream Democrats, because Powell, at the end of the day, is not just a deadhead, but he's also a Republican, and he comes from private equity, and choosing a Republican private equity manager, even if he was an attorney, right, that's not exactly appealing to the Democratic base. So, yeah, I think Powell's gone either way. Now, the question is, what kind of Fed chair is he now until then? If he cares about legacy, he obviously doesn't want to be the next Arthur Burns. So he's not going to risk another rise in inflation. And I think that probably means that the Fed chair goes out with rates where they are right now, if he has his druthers. If he doesn't need to worry about politics and the stock market, the Fed chair cares about stability in the economy. And what delivers long-term equity market returns? Economic growth, earnings growth, and you can't have those without stability. So here we are. I don't know who Trump appoints. If Trump appoints someone, I imagine it's going to be someone who would be very willing to work hand in glove with the administration. If Biden appoints someone new, I would say my money's on Lael Brainard right now as the top
contender. What would the back end of the curve do in that scenario? Biden wins the election and appoints Lael Brainard.
Bear.
What kind of rates are we looking at then?
You can make a case for a bear steeper and a bear flattener, right? So I think right away we'd probably bear steepener off the bat because you're thinking about deficits and growth. And right now we're looking at a 2.5% growth rate for the U.S. economy for the first quarter, which may seem surprising for people. But when you're running world war level deficits, then you can probably get some growth.
All right. So let's game this out a different way. Let's imagine for whatever the narrative shift that's happening right now, people a bit concerned about inflation, people concerned about decelerating growth. Let's play this through a little bit. Let's say we, regardless of whatever damage gets done, let's imagine we're not as restrictive as the market thinks and that the economy starts to show disinflationary prints and no sign of growth weakening. I think, if I'm not mistaken, GDP now just ticked up today. So, if you imagine that narrative holds and risk-taking comes back into the market from a cautious positioning right now, where are the places that you would want to be thinking about positioning now amidst market weakness in the case you do have a more constructive environment post-correction? Are there any places that you favor into the middle or back end of the year if you do get a 5 to 10% correction, but growth still looks elevated and maybe people ease off on the inflation narrative?
I think it's hard to argue against looking at the mega cap tech names still, because they're printing money hand over fist, night and day, every second, every hour. And those companies have big moats. So if you're worried about rising borrowing costs or margins being in the way, they're probably the place to look. Now, there's also idiosyncratic risk on the table there. Like, will Apple rally as much as Meta? Perhaps not, because of some of the China concerns right now. Would Tesla rebound as much as Google? Probably not, because some of the China concerns right now. I'm keeping it real simple here. I got some levels to look at in both the S&P and the NASDAQ, and I'm just waiting patiently. Last week was my worst week of the year.
Same.
It was actually my worst week that I've had going back to October of last year. I think I've had a positive week every week. This was my second negative week in 2024, and I think it was my second negative week in 6 months. But last week was a really bad week. I wiped out a good chunk of my first 3 months of my year.
The last two weeks. Go ahead.
No, well, that's what happens when you're a trend trader who's long bonds and stocks and the yen.
For sure.
And short Tesla puts.
Speaking of which,
it's been
The last 2 weeks were fairly constructive for me until they started taking out materials the last few sessions, taking them out back and shooting them. But other than that, the last 2 weeks helped me to sort of, I think it's hard for me to get on like NVIDIA trains and things of that nature. So when everybody's going, you know, piling on those Momo trades, I try to find my money the hard way. And then every once in a while you get lucky and people come for those not so loved areas. And the last 2 weeks was about playing catch up. I wonder, like, you brought up Tesla 157, down $4.30. I made this point earlier when I was talking to Tom. The read through when you let go, I think if I'm not mistaken, Tesla has like 140,000 employees, something like mm-hmm. this. So announcing a 10% layoff is something in the ballpark of 14%, or excuse me, 14,000 employees. Now that might not be, I don't know if it's 10% global workforce, 10% domestic, but I thought the number was somewhere around 14,000. Normally, when you do something like that, that's a major expense-cutting measure. The market will reward you for cheaper expenses. That has not happened at all. The market is still hammering Tesla, if not even more so since the announcement. It seems like the market is reading through that the demand side of this equation is much more important than the expenses that they're going to save with this cut. What do you think about their cut, the market reaction, and then what you do with risk here with Tesla at 157?
Oh, I was trying to sell puts recently and got kicked in the teeth. So there's that. It also runs afoul to my longstanding view that Tesla has had a Twitter problem. Mm. And I think the past few days have actually exemplified that considerably. Granted, it's not the same Twitter problem that you and I were talking about, which was the fact that foreign governments who may want certain things restricted on Twitter, or now X, could say, lean on Elon Musk and say, hey, that's a nice little gigafactory you got there. Shame if something happened to it.
No,
you want those tax credits? So it's a different kind of Twitter problem. It's the fact that Elon Musk tweets. A few days ago when Reuters reported that Tesla was getting ready to lay off 10% of its workforce, Elon tweeted that Reuters lies and the stock got a bounce. And then Electric came out with the report that they're cutting 10% of their workforce. And it wasn't rebuffed because Electric has been a friend for Tesla and a cheerleader for Tesla and the broader, you know, EV landscape for a number of years. And the report's true. They're cutting around 10% of their workforce. Even whole Mars catalog, that Twitter fanboy that always tweets everything at Elon Musk, they said that there's a cut coming. Again, sourcing from Electric, but still, the people who orbit this in social media are substantiating it. So that's your problem now. Elon Musk just told you something about the company a few days ago that may be patently false. Do you trust this person steering the ship of a company that is several times more overvalued than traditional OEMs like your Ford, GM, and is not performing financially on the scale of software, AI companies like a Google or a Meta or a Microsoft? How do you value it appropriately? Mm. Because I was looking at the long-term PEG ratio for Tesla today. PEG ratio is the price to earnings ratio divided by the long-term growth rate. Companies like Apple, Microsoft, Google, they have PEG ratios right around 1-2 at the high end. Tesla's PEG ratio is north of 8 still. This is a company by any traditional fundamental valuation is massively overvalued. And so you put all that in the context of what's happening in the electric vehicle market worldwide. China's become a behemoth in vehicle production recently. Later this year, it's going to become the world's largest manufacturer of vehicles, surpassing Japan. And moreover, it's going to be the world's largest exporter of electric vehicles. Last year, its electric vehicle exports grew by 63%. And they're exporting models from companies like BYD that cost consumers about $15,000. Mm-hmm. How on earth is Tesla going to compete, not here in America, where there could be protectionism and subsidies, which there have been, tax credits, if you will, but what happens to Tesla abroad when they can't compete with those kind of vehicles? Their margins are going to get destroyed. They're not going to be able to sell in countries that import BYD unless they create a cheaper mouse wheel, cheaper mousetrap. And that's been the goal, right? We've seen this over time. You create a high-end vehicle that gives you the revenue that allows you to develop the medium-end vehicle, which gives you enough revenue and higher volume to mass produce the cheap car. That was the game plan. I never quite got to mass producing the cheap car. So Tesla has a real fundamental market structure problem with it right now. That's what I wrote about for Luckbox magazine last month. So you would have thought I would have put that in my head and said, do I really want to sell puts here? Of course not. But Tesla has an issue. And so calling the bottom here is hugely problematic, just like it's problematic with Apple, because so much of the story of the decline or struggles of these companies in 2024 has been what's happening to their customer base in China. And Chinese industry and Chinese companies have now grown to the point where they can compete on the world stage with their Western counterparts. And so that technological edge that Tesla had, that pricing advantage that Tesla had, is just not there. And I think there's a bigger problem here besides China as well. The market's so saturated, man. Everyone, basically everyone, because I wouldn't mind an electric vehicle. I don't have one, but I wouldn't mind one, right? Pretty much everyone who wants an EV at this point has one. Canada has a mandate where there's 20% of all vehicle sales by 2025 or 2026 are supposed to be EV, and companies aren't producing or aren't able to sell enough cars to meet those goals. And so those companies may be penalized financially for not meeting the government mandated goals. There's a whole problem here. There's too much supply coming in at really cheap levels, and there's not enough demand in the system right now. And that's why companies like Stellantis and Toyota, when you look at them, their stocks are doing quite well, because they didn't go full throttle pivot into EV. They went to hybrid, fully understanding that we don't have the infrastructure and the stepping stones to get us to a green future. We don't have the charging stations. We don't have nuclear. It's a huge problem. And so what do you have to do? Oil is not going away. As someone who believes in climate change, I've said this to you before, as a trader, you got to set that stuff aside, folks, because there's opportunity in the market that may run afoul of your personal convictions, your political convictions. The reality is that oil's not going away, probably not in our lifetime, Zach, because we don't have the infrastructure in place to get it there. So you have infrastructure problems, you have demand and supply issues, you have valuations that are out of whack. The best thing Elon could do is just, I've said this for years now with you, make someone else the permanent CEO of Twitter and step back. Go back to only tweeting rocket launches and talking about great tech improvements and sharing inspiring videos from Neuralink. Stop tweeting the culture war stuff. Just focus, right? Focus. That's the best thing for Tesla right now. Elon must focus, because it has all this other stuff going on that's outside of his control that he cannot influence whatsoever. Maybe we're going to see $100 a share again. Who knows? But it doesn't seem out of the ordinary. I'd like to buy, but I got just stabbed in the face trying to do so, trying to fade the market move lower. And so I guess it's just time to wait. But there are real problems here for Tesla, plain and simple.
So that was a lot there. That was a beautiful answer. So one, I think a couple responses. So the way I'm playing this is like with ratios. So, and don't follow me, I'm an idiot, but like, I think, you know, an example would be like selling the 145s and buying two of the 140s. And, you know, if you get a move lower, those 140s are gonna pick up delta, and, you know, wherever your short put is, perhaps if that's an area that you'd like to own it, some people probably don't wanna own this thing or be wearing Tesla at 145. Maybe you wanna wear it, you know, somewhere at 100 or below. To your point, you were comparing Tesla's PEG to like an Apple. What I think is, you know, perhaps more appropriate is to look at GM and Ford, and their price earnings, their PEG is something like 0.5. So, you know, if you start pricing Tesla like an actual car company, which I don't know is fully warranted, but it shows you where your potential floor could be. That's one. Number two, I thought the Reuters thing, it was in response to them reporting not the layoffs, but that they were doing away with their low model. So like the $20,000 or $25,000 new model, which Reuters reported, which Tesla said was, or excuse me, Elon said was a lie. And to your point, I totally agree that these low price point Chinese companies, what it's most likely going to create is protectionist auto policies. You've already seen the Euro start squawking about it. You saw Janet Yellen when she went over to China start squawking about overcapacity, which was effectively, you know, some code word for saying that you guys are dumping. And so
you're making too much stuff and you're selling it too cheap in too many markets and it's screwing up the rest of our economies. Right.
But I mean, go back in time and look at the hundreds of billions of dollars that we've already committed to our EV companies and structure, and compare that to like the $3.5 or $4 billion that supposedly went to BYD, and it's like we're not comparing apples to apples here. To your point about Elon Musk not tweeting, I'm of two minds on that. If I'm just a pure Tesla investor, and I do have some shares, but again, I have a sort of a hedge, a downside 140 hedge. I don't mind. I used to say that. I don't mind him talking, you know, because I feel like he's one of the only people saying the things that need to be said. And he's one of the few people that have a platform to express what I feel, not all the time, but many times, are relevant side of the argument that are drowned out, that are censored, that are ignored or called conspiracy theories. When some,
you know, I guess I'm not concerned too much about him tweeting about that kind of stuff, but like tweeting things about his companies that are demonstrably false, right? Like that his knee-jerk reaction now is always, if there's an accusation, deny. If there's something that's unfavorable to him, spin it the other way. It's very reactionary right now. I mean, like he does feel like a different person than 5 years ago. And so just reaction, here's something he's being accused of, Tesla's gonna cut some of its workforce. No, mainstream media is lying. But then it turns out to be true. That only hurts his credibility. So if he wants to talk about whatever, you know, post his memes, fine, go for it. Like, it's your company, do whatever you want, obviously. But if I'm a Tesla shareholder, I want him to just kind of like knock it off. And that's the dichotomy that, you know, this is what happens in life. Like sometimes what's it called being professional or being courteous? You kind of bite your tongue for the sake of achieving another goal. And I think that for Elon, maybe not constantly attacking and refuting every single negative thing that comes out about his companies could actually be good for them, because it's not a boy who cried wolf situation, right? Like this, how can you look at anything he says about Tesla now that these job cuts look like they're coming down the line, and believe him when he says something's true or false? He just demonstrated that he's not an honest narrator in these situations. Mm.
I see your point there. I used to parrot that position. I used to fully back that position. And maybe if I had more Tesla exposure, I'd be pissed off. I'd be all in.
Fair enough.
But because the total Delta exposure is low enough where I'm like, you know what, if it goes to 80, whatever, that I think there's more to be gained by people expressing their opinions right now in this weird little moment of history than him worrying about getting the stock from 160 to 175. But again, I know there's a bunch of Tesla investors that don't want to hear that and want to believe that their CEO has a fiduciary responsibility to make sure he's doing what's in their best behalf. So I get that side of the argument too.
That's really like my angle here, right? Like what's best for the shareholder in that perspective. But again, 5 years ago, forget who Elon was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, Tesla had a very different environment. It looked like it might be able to achieve, you know, global dominance in the EV market. It looked like it was going to be able to give you, you know, was it level 3, 5? I don't know. Full wheel automated driving, right? The FSD system. Mm-hmm. And those things haven't come to pass. And now they're facing a lot more competition at a time when the CEO looks like he's increasingly distracted. So it's just not a good mix from a pure PR perspective. At the end of the day, may Tesla win out, of course. Could this be a blip on the radar like we've seen in years past and they overcome it? Absolutely, no one's discounting that. But the odds are getting more and more stacked against them over time. They had a first mover advantage and they may have lost it, quite frankly. They didn't get to the end point of being able to mass produce a car cheap enough for the Western world quickly enough before someone else came in, and that could be BYD.
I do agree his focus is always part of the narrative. I don't know that it's ever really part of the price, you know. Would your thinking about Elon and his quote unquote focus be, would that be worth 0.5% in how you value the company or the multiple you're willing to pay? Probably
absolutely
not. I don't think so.
If Elon comes out tomorrow,
how do you price that?
If Elon comes out tomorrow and says, I'm stepping back from SpaceX, I'm handing over Twitter, my Twitter feed's going to be automated, I'm focused on one thing and one thing only, Tesla, I think the share rips 10 or 15% on the news.
But that's not going to happen.
I mean, no. But that's where, you know, kind of where I'm at. I think that's how big of a liability it is right now. And people know this themselves. Like, have you ever tried to do the dishes when your kid's asking for something? Or fold the laundry when they're jumping on the bed? Yeah, he's a billionaire, so he has a lot more help than people like you and me do. But the fact is that people have only 24 hours a day. They need sleep. They have finite attention. They have stress. They have all these problems. And when you look at the performance of the company's metrics, you can't help but wonder, hey, things started to turn south once this guy's attention got divided up. Maybe it would be better if he stepped away from one company, from all of them, let other people jump in, because he's still going to make the money, right? It's not like he's going to lose control of your shares. But, you know, again, bigger problem for Tesla, bigger problem for Apple. You have China. You have domestic competition coming out of China, whereas Apple and Tesla were able to feed on the Chinese consumer for years and years and years because they had a great product that was readily available for the masses that no Chinese product could compete with. That's no longer the case. Mm.
What do you think about metals here? Gold at 2,400, silver a little bit weaker at 28, 22. And we touched 30 the other day before backing off. Little rally here. Opened higher yesterday and faded. What's your opinion? And we can throw copper in there as well. But gold, silver, copper. Do you have an opinion on any of the metals?
I think that the participation in these metals has been so slim in recent years. If you look at GLD inflows or SLV inflows, you look to the futures market positioning prior to the big rally we just had a few weeks ago. No one was trading these things. So a lot of people have missed the move and have been underinvested. But if you take a step back and look at weekly or monthly charts, gold and silver look like they're just breaking out now after trading in a consolidation or a downtrend for 3 years, or going back to 2011 in silver's case, for example. So I see nothing other than a desire to get long when possible. Now, granted, this has been like the psychological hurdle for me with metals recently, because I was already long silver at the start of February and then got out and then had a plan to get back in, and then I just didn't execute on it, and silver's been up another 12% since then. So it's kind of killing me inside. But the long-term charts look really good. And quite frankly, I don't know how anyone can determine what's a fair value for these metals. Do you use money supplies from central bank? Do you use debts, deficits? Do you use real interest rates? Because there's no cash flows, dividends, coupons, payments. And therefore, it's hard for me to decide what's a fair value for gold or silver. But I also think about the fact that gold and silver tend to track their volatility. And this is, you know, I really would love if we had like an IVR 1 and an IVR 5 and an IVR 10. Like, show me the relative volatility in gold over the past decade compared to where it is today. Because if you look at GVZ, the gold volatility ticker, which is based on the options chain from GC, you'll see that GVZ is nowhere near the highs where it was 2 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And so, yes, gold vol on a relative basis right now is high. Over the past year, it may be in the 90th percentile. But over the past 10 years, it's certainly not. So gold vol can go up. I'm very ambivalent about anyone jumping in here to sell calls. It may work on a day-to-day basis. I think for retail traders, that's kryptonite. So I wouldn't do it. I'm not doing it. If I'm going to short gold, I'm short MGC. Otherwise, and I'm not even going to short MGC. I am exclusively looking to get in long at this point in time. It's not for geopolitics. I kind of just like the charts. The charts on a monthly basis, you look at the past 10 or 20 years, they look like they are just starting to break out. And I'm a trend trader, so I'll jump onto the long trend if that's the way the market's moving. Hmm.
What do you think if it's, you might not have an answer to the next question if you're participating purely on a technical basis, not necessarily some sort of confluence of factors, yields doing this, risk doing this. But what do you think in your mind, what do you think the risk is to derailing the gold trade or just the metals trade in general? I think it's hard. Like, if you can't pinpoint why you think something's rallying, it's hard to know why the rally ends, right? So, like, staying with the technicals might make sense, and you're looking for some sort of moving average crossover on the downside to know when your trade is over. But if there's something else fueling the upside demand for you, then maybe you have a reason why you would not want to take a position.
When I think about gold in that context, I think about Bitcoin. One of the phrases that was tossed around a lot in the 2010s about Bitcoin was that it had narrative flexibility. Mm. Halving coming up, bullish. Oh, treasury adoption from corporates, bullish. Sovereigns are using it, bullish. Oh, Lightning Network, everything is bullish. Market price is going up. You can find something in the news that day and say that's why price is going up. And it feels like gold, after having zero narrative flexibility for a long time, now has a ton of it at its hands, right? Oil prices are going up. Inflation expectations are up. The Fed's not going to cut again or raise rates again, excuse me. So real Fed funds rate is going down, bullish gold. Oh, war in the Middle East is off. Okay. Well, it looks like oil's coming off. So yields can go down. Well, if yields are going down, well, gold likes lower nominal yields. So I guess that's bullish. I mean, I see the narrative flexibility here right now in the short term. So that would have to disappear, right? And that would mean inflation has to die and the Fed can't cut rates for a while. I think we may have reset the higher for longer window as well, which is the other side of this when it all washes over on gold. Because the Fed rattled off 6 months of improving inflation data. And this was in January 31st, when someone asked, well, Chair Powell, if it's 6 months, who's to say 8 months is going to be enough by the time you get to March? And he goes, I don't know. We'll have to see. And so if we're at a point right now where having 6 months in January wasn't good, and now we have 3 months in a row that are bad, do we have to go 6 months in a row again, at least with good data, to get us there? So there's a window right now where gold just can kind of run. It has narrative flexibility. The Fed cutting, not cutting. I mean, we don't know what they're going to do, when they're going to do it. So how high? 25, 26, 28, 3,000? I have no idea. I'm not going to call a number out. But the technicals are strong, and until they fall over. I mean, inflation last week, we hit a new all-time high the next day after the inflation surprise, even as bond yields ripped. That's the narrative flexibility I'm talking about.
Is a cut good for the Chinese economy? A U.S. Federal Reserve cut, is that good for the Chinese economy?
Maybe indirectly, insofar as that lower rates in the U.S. can stimulate aggregate demand here, and we buy a ton of stuff from China, so that may mean more money going abroad. I'm exporting things here. But also, Fed rate cuts could also weaken the U.S. dollar, in turn making the yuan stronger, which then makes Chinese exports less competitive to their Asian peers like the yen or the South Korean yuan. So I would, you know, is it good or bad? There's probably risks on both sides. I wouldn't think that a Fed cut, when you balance everything out, has a material impact one side of the equation or the other.
But I do agree with you that you explained it a little bit differently than I would, but it's the same thinking, which is, if you see the world through left tail, right tail, left tail is Fed overstays their welcome, you get a recession, potentially deflationary environment. That's theoretically a positive environment to be protecting purchasing power with gold. On the right hand side, you get cuts before you put inflation genie back in the bottle, and there's less trust in U.S. treasuries, especially the long end of the curve, in terms of collateral. That is potentially still a decent environment for gold, depending on what China's doing, if you believe China is the major buyer here and continues to be a marginal buyer in that environment. So yeah, I sort of agree with you that if you just evaluate the tails, you can make a case for supportive environments in both sides of the tail. And while that's still the case, you continue to have a supportive environment. The problem is, if you go back in the history, and I know we're running up on time, if you go back in the history, silver, there's a reason why silver is the high beta play relative to gold. And if you can get moves up to 30 this quickly, but you can get that exact same volatility to the downside, and you've seen it a little bit in these markets. Go back a few years, go look at a monthly long-term chart of silver, and there's been some months that actually, just take people's heads off. So the only thing that I would say out there is, as people start to, there are more people that want to deploy risk towards these trades, just be careful about what instruments you're using, how you're testing your up and downside hypothesis, and how ultimately you have risk management in place. Because what seems like a good trade today, especially in some of these metals, can be largely unforgiving overnight. Last thing for you, man. As you look at the rest of this week, and we're not going to get a chance to talk for another week. Is there one particular instrument that either you want to play long or short for a very short period of time? I know that's not always how you look at the market, so feel free to balk on the question.
Yeah, I mentioned before for stocks, I kind of have my levels, and that's all I'm waiting around right now. I don't have levels in bonds because I think that those cut odds now need to be taken off the board. And so the SR3 M4 contract needs to go down, and so does the Z4 contract little by little. And quite frankly, SR3 M4 is still pricing in about an 18% chance of a cut in June. So if we don't get a cut in June, that percentage needs to be zeroed out. I don't want to use the term free money, but it kind of feels like that's an easy trade on the table. I know SR3 isn't like the sexiest thing that people trade, but something to think about in the back of your head. For the S&P right now, it's really simple. At the middle end of February, there's a swing high up near 5125. And then after we break above 5125 in the last week of February and the start of March, it becomes support. And the price action in the S&P over the past, we'll call it 36 hours, is once we broke down through 5125 today, overnight, that's been our ceiling. So I look at that level as a problem because in context of the head and shoulders pattern that the S&P 500 may be trading in, I see now a 45-point range. Today's low, the lows this week, right around 5078 and 5125. If we're above 5125 in the short term, you have a chance for a tradable low. Volatility's high. Look for selling some short-term puts, put spread on a very short-term basis. Look for a bounce through the end of the week. If we're below 5078, the head and shoulders pattern is still exerting itself. And that measured move, the way I measured it, 5333.50 minus a neckline of 5167.25 gives you a target of 5000.25. So like that's kind of my immediate short-term trajectory right now. I'm obviously not going to sell a strangle or do an iron condor between 5125 and 5078. So I'm going to wait to take a short-term directional bet. If it's long, look long above 5125 and see where that goes, right? Can we hold this? Can it build? Is it just a short-term bounce? And then if it's below 5078, wait to get down to 5000, see what the IBRs look like, see if there's an opportunity to get long at that level, because I am a longer-term bull, right? And so I don't like trading against my bias. I still think there are points to be put on the scoreboard this year. But after having my worst week of the year, it's time to wait. And the worst thing that traders can do when you have a really bad run is over trade. Just like when you have a really good run, the worst thing you can do is lever up because you get cocky. The worst thing you can do is panic and overtrade. So right now I'm kind of just going back to the drawing board, seeing what went wrong last week, why I didn't react strong enough in time, and move from there and then pick up the pieces and go on. But a lot of the things that we kind of anticipated, DBC breaking out, oil getting to 85 and causing funny things, those are happening. So the worldview isn't completely broken. The mental model is still intact for now. But this is a give me about 5125 or below 5078 and we can talk. Until then, I'm flat.
Right on, man. If the people, I'm sure most of these people are longtime watchers of Tasty, but just in case anybody's watching for the first time and they'd like to hear more of your commentary on Tasty Live Network, can you tell them where they can go? What days and times can they watch?
Good question. And I have a great answer. Every Monday through Friday, 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 Central Time, Futures Power Hour. Also Monday through Thursdays, Overtime, 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central. Usually on Tuesdays, let me explain, with Tom and Tony at 9:40 a.m. Eastern. But Victor and I flip-flop this week, so I'll be on this Thursday morning instead. And of course, on the website formerly known as Twitter, at CVecchioFX.
My man, it's always a pleasure to get the opportunity to chop it up with you. I'm looking forward to being able to do this with you every Tuesday going forward. Tomorrow, Ilya is going to be on. Thursday, everybody, we're going to be running a replay. I will be on a plane, so I won't get the opportunity to do a live show, but we'll be back in action next Monday. So tune in tomorrow with Ilya. Same time, same place, same great network, only on Tasty Live. Until then, hit the like button, subscribe to the channel. If you're watching on demand, leave a comment. Tell us what you think about Tesla. Tell us what you think about gold and how you're playing bonds. If the Fed cuts, let's imagine in June, what do you think the long end does? And lastly, how are you playing overall risk in equities for the next week? Leave us a comment. Tell us what you think. We do watch it. And sometimes I use them as trade ideas. I'm not going to lie. I do cheat and use your answers for my homework. Until next time, everybody, I've been Victor Jones.
I've been Chris Vecchio.
We'll see you next time. Peace.
The content of this podcast is created, produced, and provided solely by Tasty Life, Inc., and does not represent the direct views or opinions of any of its affiliated companies. This content is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not, nor is it intended to be, trading or investment advice or a recommendation that any security, futures contract, digital asset, other product, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any person. Trading securities, futures products, and digital assets involve risk and may result in a loss greater than the original amount invested. Tasty Live Inc., through its content, financial programming, or otherwise, does not provide investment or financial advice or make investment recommendations. The information provided may not be appropriate for all investors and is provided without respect to individual investor financial sophistication, financial situation, investing time horizon, or risk tolerance. Tasty Live Inc. is not a licensed financial advisor, registered investment advisor, registered broker-dealer, or registered introducer.